Mark Thompson on Music Mill FM.
Hello, you're listening to the Music Mill. I'm Mark Thompson here with you for the next hour, talking about some of the top news stories of the last few days. So coming up in the next half hour, I'll be speaking to Gawain Toler, who is head of press for UKIP and a former MEP candidate for the South West region, about the EU referendum. Then after that, we'll be joined by technology journalist Nicole Coby to discuss broadband and mobile phone coverage in the light of MPs having debated this subject on Monday.
Contact Mark now. Tweet at Mark Reckons.
So yes, if you want to get in touch with me, I'm on Twitter at Mark Reckons. You can tweet me about anything we're talking about. I am delighted to be joined by Gawain Toler, who is head of press for UKIP and a former MEP candidate for the South West region. Good evening, Gawain.
Good evening, Mark.
How are you doing?
Oh, I think I'm surviving.
Good, good. Sorry to have dragged you out of the pub tonight, by the way.
Well, no, it's absolutely disgraceful. We live.
Yeah, you're taking one for the team tonight. So, there's quite a lot to talk about with the whole EU referendum thing. I mean, obviously, it's been a live issue for quite a long time now, and there's been some activity this week. So there's been the launch of the, I'm not sure what we're supposed to call it. We're supposed to call it the In campaign, the Remain campaign, the Stay campaign.
I guess, if given the Election Commission has decided what we're calling it, it's going to be the Remain campaign, isn't it?
Yeah. It's not quite as punchy as In or Stay, though, is it?
It's two syllables instead of one.
Yeah.
And it is a sort of, in a classic sort of Churchillian language, always better to have one syllable if you're trying to get a message through. But it's the same with leave and out. Leave is a much gentler word, out is much harder, in is a much harder word, remain is a much gentler. But I think that it is, in some ways, the change made by the Electoral Commission was make the clearer. I think
it is a better question. Yeah. Okay. So, you're... Well, actually, there are two different leave campaigns, aren't there, at the moment? I presume you're involved with one of them.
Well, no, not really. I'm involved in UKIP. I'm involved neither in the... what was Business for Britain, which is now Vote Leave, nor, indeed, the banks operation, which is leave.eu. I'm somewhere in between, in the middle, neither one thing nor the other, fish nor fowl. But it is, my attitude, and I'm pleased to say the attitude of UKIP as a whole, is we'll work with anybody who wishes to leave the EU. And now that the Business for Britain, the sort of hashtag for Britain groups, such as the Conservatives for Britain, Labour for Britain, Business for Britain, Students for Britain, and so on and so forth, have moved from their previous position, which was they were not yet committed, which was their position last week, to the one that they took on the weekend, which was a launch of their "we are now committed, we've looked at what the Prime Minister is suggesting in these negotiations, and frankly we're not impressed, so we are now going to state categorically that we wish the country to leave the European Union." And now that they've done that, UKIP is happy to do everything we can to help them. Previous to that, because they hadn't made that commitment to leave, it was very hard for a party that has been going for the last 20, 23 years, basically banging the drum to leave, to give wholehearted support to very well-meaning, very intelligent, very able, but yet not committed people.
Okay, so it sounds like you don't think it matters too much which of the two main leave campaigns actually gets Electoral Commission go ahead. I mean, it is important which one does, doesn't it? Because they get money to spend and they get a free mail shop.
Financially, really, yeah. And sort of kudos and things of that sort. I think that it is a... Yes, it is important. The people who get the Election Commission tick will, of course, receive a certain amount of state funding, something I have issues with anyhow, personally. And they will get the access to the media, and they will also have sort of party political, non-party political broadcasts. That's fine. UKIP isn't actually interested in any of that stuff because we are a political party and we are pretty clear as to where we stand. And the idea that the boss, Mr. Farage, is not going to be one of the chief spokesmen, whether he is part of the Leave, Vote Leave, or part of leave.eu, is frankly risible. He is probably the most recognised Eurosceptic in the country these days. And as such, our position, his position, is that we will bang our drum, we will continue doing what we're doing, we'll continue organising public meetings hither and thither. I don't know, you may or may not have heard, and 2 nights ago he was up at the station gatehead, 1,300 people rocked up, not a bad crowd.
Is this like Farage's equivalent of Corbyn mania, is it? Is that Farage's equivalent of, like, the Corbyn mania? Were people queuing outside?
I reckon we've been doing it for a little bit longer than Mr. Corbyn.
Right.
We've been bimbling around the country for a long time now. We've been having these meetings, having public meetings. I mean, I've got a suspicion that Corbyn has looked at the success of our public meetings and actually going out and talking to people in their town, in many cases over the last few years in their villages, having public meetings, trying to engage directly with people rather than through the medium of Twitter or Facebook or the TV or the newspapers, actually rocking up and rolling up into the village hall, rolling up into the, and in the case of Gateshead, of course, into a magnificent publicly funded, EU-funded performance space.
Does that give you a little kind of frisson of excitement to be using EU-funded places?
As I'm sure you're aware, my attitude is it's our money anyhow. So,
yeah.
The fact is that we will, and we are, and there are, of course, Farage isn't doing them all, but we've got over 300 public meetings booked before the end of this year up and down the country in all four home nations, banging the drum, taking the message out there. And we're going to continue doing that anyhow. Until the Vote Leave and the Matthew Elliotts and the Lord Lawsons and so on and so forth actually said, right, we're it, we're going. We were very much supportive of Aaron Banks and his crew because they've got on and gone out there. They've now got 250,000 supporters on Facebook. They are doing stuff. And interestingly, whilst they have an office in Westminster, I think what's extremely key to them is that they are based in Bristol. They're working outside the M25. And let's be honest, this referendum is going to be won and lost not in the Beltway, not within Westminster, not within the M25, but in the country at large.
Yeah, indeed. So, how do you think things are looking at the moment? I mean, there was a time when there seemed to be increasing support for leaving the EU, but in recent times, the pictures looked a bit more mixed than that. If anything, it's maybe slid slightly the other way.
I would say I am more sanguine now than I have been for a while, there's no doubt about it. I've been banging this drum and playing this game now for 12, 13 years. I was considering throwing the towel in at the election. And then we got the referendum, and there's no way I'm going to give up now.
You were considering throwing in the towel. Is that because there was a good chance that Ed Miliband was going to become Prime Minister?
Well, it's more that I've been doing the job for this particular job for 6 years. And it's very long in the tooth for somebody in my role.
Yeah.
However, there's no way I can chuck it in now, not when we're a year and a half, or at tops 2 years away from, as I see it, and I wouldn't pretend that everybody that's listening in or yourself would see it as the key question in our political lifetime.
I would certainly say it's the key. It's going to be the key moment of this parliament, perhaps even this decade. I'm not sure about lifetime.
That'll do.
Well, I mean, it's undeniable. I mean, it's going to change everything, isn't it? You know,
it is huge. I mean, essentially, maybe it's the famous Ted Heath question: who governs Britain?
Yeah.
Well, actually, it is the Ted Heath question: who governs Britain, and who do we, the people, wish to govern Britain? And that matters.
Yeah, I mean, what I was going to ask is, there seems to be roughly a third of the country that would vote to stay in, come what may, and there seems to be about a third of the country that will vote to stay out, come what may. Roughly looking at the analysis of the polling figures, so there's about a third of people in the middle who appear to be, at least to some degree or another, persuadable. How do you think, or what do you think, is the best way to go about persuading those people? Because there are some who say that having Nigel Farage fronting or very, very visible in the campaign isn't going to be good to try and persuade that group of people. And he appeals more to the people who are already going to vote out anyway.
I think that there is, well, that's certainly true, but of course he does, because he is the recognisable face of, and has been for many years now, the face of Out.
But they're banked. We know how they're going to vote. So they, in a way, they don't matter very much. It's more the people in the middle, isn't it?
Well, UKIP have never presumed, and we're not quite as fat-headed as we sometimes pretend to be. We do not presume that we got just under 4 million votes in May. We got 4.5 million votes last year in the Euros, which obviously is our bag, and we won it. However, to win this you're not going to be comfortable without 18 to 20 million. If you, and people have, and they've done the numbers and all the rest of it, if you say that between the 4 and the 4.5 million, you're probably looking at 5.5 all told, who have voted UKIP in the last 2 years. That's not enough. That's certainly not enough. And we fully understand that there's no way that just UKIP will win this. But it's not just UKIP in this game. There are plenty of people on the left, there's plenty of people on the centre-right who feel the same way as we do about democracy and accountability. And I don't think, when it comes to national elections, general elections, I think you're probably right. Nigel is obviously not somebody who appeals across the board. But when it comes to Europe, I think it's a slightly different ballgame. That being said, as I say, we're not asking to be the chief spokespeople, because we know, we want a farmer to talk to the farming community. We want a businessman to talk to the business community. We want fishermen to talk to the fishing community. We want people from across the board to come forward and say, well, actually, in my field, in my business, in my life, getting out would do the country better and do me better and do my family better and my children better. So I think what you'll find is that there is no one single leader of the Out campaign, and Nigel is very effective in his way, and other people will be equally effective. And Nigel Lawson will appeal very much to a certain set of, dare I say, middle to late, older Tories. Someone like Kate Hoey has a strong appeal to a certain section of the Labour movement. And I'm sure, sadly, Bob Crowe's no longer with us, but there will be union figures who also have that sort of appeal. And Unison is humming and hawing about the whole deal. So, I mean, horses for courses.
Mm. Okay, in terms of timing, what's your gut feeling about what's going to happen? Because there was some talk earlier this year that Cameron could go to the country with the referendum as early as spring next year, spring 2016. I mean, from my perspective, that's seeming less and less likely now, because
I think that is unlikely. I mean, today, over in Brussels, the latest sort of squeaks and farts that come out of the Commission, the sort of terminology of the Commission, suggest that it will be on, Britain's negotiating position will be on the agenda in the December Council. But that's merely the negotiating position. We have heard time and time again from our friends on the continent that they are getting frustrated by the lack of detail from our government, as Mr. Cameron and Mr. Osborne and others discuss things. And we talk about technical negotiations, don't they? And yet, when you speak to the people he's technically negotiating with, they go, well, actually, we haven't had any detail yet. I don't know how technical things can be. And if you ask an engineer to do technical stuff, they're getting down to the nitty-gritty. But actually, that doesn't seem to be the case when you talk to those people that we're supposed to be talking to on the continent. We don't know what's going on. We don't know what's in Cameron's mind. We certainly don't know what they are planning. The Telegraph, as I'm sure you're aware, posited 4 points over the weekend. This is what the negotiation would be. But I think that was the Telegraph choosing the breeze.
So, I mean, I suppose I can guess what your answer to this question is going to be.
Yeah.
But do you think that Cameron is at least sincere in his purported attempt to try and negotiate a better deal for the country, or do you think that's just a fig leaf so that he can come back and say he's got something in the way that leaders always do whenever they go for negotiations? It's always a triumph, isn't it? I mean, do you think he's just playing that game? Do you think he's playing that game, or do you think he genuinely is trying to get a better deal for the country in the hope that he can win the referendum?
I think Cameron is a pragmatist, and he, a while back, looked at the electoral numbers in the UK and thought he had to square away UKIP supporters. So he offered a referendum. But he also looked at the other numbers, suggesting that if David Cameron comes back with anything, people trust him on this, and he reckoned, with the support of business and the unions and various other, and most of Labour and the Lib Dems and so on and so forth, that he could win the referendum and put this issue to a bed. Cameron is not an ideologue. I think that he believes that Britain should remain in the European Union. I think he finds, like many people in the political class, it's always good to have somebody to blame. We have a migration crisis, let's blame the EU. But there's nothing we can do about it. We have this problem, but we can blame the EU. And it is always useful to have somebody else to blame as an elected politician. I think that has been is helpful for him. Yes, I think he is at gut, at heart, a soft Eurosceptic. I think he's uncomfortable with the level of power that the EU has. You just have to, though he was quite rapidly shut up back in 2011, Oliver Letwin, the silent man of British politics, who still remains in the cabinet after all, spoke, and what he said was, I've looked at the reforms, we can't do much because of our relationship with the European Union. So I think there is is he genuine in wanting reform? I think he is a perfect world. I'm sure he does, but this is not a perfect world. And he also knows the limit of what he can achieve in negotiations with Europe. And as such, what have we got? The only thing he's mentioned is a change of the protocol about ever closer union. There's going to be an annex to the treaty that gives Britain an opt-out on the words ever closer union. And it is... dusting, isn't it?
Well, symbolism's important, though, isn't it? I mean, you know,
symbolism is important, but honestly, it's a bit. Do you remember when the Dutch and French voted no on the constitution, and so we had the Nice Treaty instead, and all that was changed to allow the Dutch to go back to their people and say it's all right, Gov, but of course they didn't give them another referendum, was to say that the flag and the anthem would not be formally part of the European Union. They may not be formally part of the European Union, but it's an amazing formally informal sense in which the flag and the anthem are, in fact, part of the European Union. Symbols, you are quite right. But do we really, I don't know, the country can opt out of ever closer union while still remaining part of the European Union is, to my mind, ridiculous. Now, he may well get an annex, but everybody's going to be giggling behind their hands, as will he be. Ho-ho, I've come back with this annex saying we're not part of ever closer union. Well, we will be.
Do you think he might pull a rabbit or even a couple of rabbits out of a hat, though? Because, I mean, Cameron and Osborne, actually, are political showmen, aren't they? I mean, they like to spring surprises. I mean, you see it with Osborne twice a year, once in the budget and once in the autumn statement, which is actually rapidly becoming a budget in and of itself, but that's an aside. I'm thinking, is it possible that Cameron comes back with something much firmer on immigration than anyone's expecting and actually manages to get Merkel and some of the others to
there is no doubt. There is no doubt that number 10 and number 11 are, and the Foreign Office, are playing down expectations to a ridiculous degree. And therefore, your suggestion, I think, is apposite. It's sensible. I wouldn't be at all surprised if they come back with some sort of deal about European migrants being able to access benefit, out-of-work benefit. I'm certain that they'll be able to do something like that. Now, my attitude is, so what? I mean, really, the number of European migrants who claim out-of-work benefits is tiny in comparison to the number of migrants who are here. It is interesting. I mean, the Tories have been banging this drum. Now, they dropped it, if the Telegraph is to believe, from their four things they want. But I would be very surprised if, having damped down expectations to such a massive degree, they come back and say, look, we can do this, but we're talking 40,000 people. It's peanuts. But I wouldn't... I'm sure you're right. I'm absolutely sure you're right. There will be some whiz-bang thing. They may come back and say, did you know the European Union was going to ban shoelaces? And we'll stop them doing so. Aren't we great?
it's sounding like Jim Hacker's sausage triumph now.
Well, yeah. As we all know, that programme is in fact a guidebook rather than a satire.
I think a lot of politicians feel that way, actually. In fact, I believe it was based on some real stuff that happened within Harold Wilson's cabinet.
But they will come back with something. Of course they will. And I'm sure in their chats with chanceries around Europe, they will say, guys, look, we've got to have something. We need something some red meat to keep off the baying mob of people like Farage and UKIP. We need to prove sensible and serious and grown up, and we, through negotiation, can get something back. And our friends on the continent aren't thick. They know that too. However, having damped down expectations, as I say, to come back with some proof that they've stopped the ban on shoelaces or whatever it is, will be perceived at the time, and I'm sure the newspapers will be primed to say how wonderful the success was, as they were when Major came back, game, set, and match for Britain, and all the rest of it. When Tony Blair came back about his great, France was going to look at the common agricultural policy. That's why we gave up a chunk of our rebate. And did they? Did they, heck? So, yes, we will be prepared for some glorious victory on the plains of Europe. Another victory in Flanders for the British. But it won't amount to a string of beans.
OK. Well, it's been great to talk to you tonight, Gawain. And this issue's going to run. I mean, obviously, we don't know when the referendum's going to be yet, but I think it's at the earliest going to be probably next autumn and maybe even the following year. So,
Well, it can't be after June next year because Britain holds the presidency.
Ah, right. Well,
June 17. It's got to be before June 17 because Britain holds the European presidency. And the idea of running a referendum campaign in the midst of Britain holding the presidency is bizarre.
Yeah, I mean, there are other reasons why he wouldn't want it to push into 2017 because of the electoral cycles in France and Germany as well. So I think we may well see it towards the end of next year or very early in 2017. But whenever it is, and actually probably well before, I'd love to get you back on again to have a further chat about how the land lies once the campaigns are both, the two main ones are both running in earnest.
Only too happy to do so.
Good stuff. Thank you very much. That's Gawain Toler, who is head of press for UKIP and a former MEP candidate.
Mark Thompson on Music Mill FM.
Hello, yes, it's Mark Thompson here with you for the next half hour. You can get me on Twitter at Mark Reckons if you want to let me know what you're thinking about any of the things we're talking about. So we just talked about the EU referendum with Gawain Toler, who is head of press for UKIP. And now we're going to move on to talk about broadband coverage. So there was a debate in Parliament earlier this week on Monday, where MPs debated this issue, and I think it is quite a hot topic for a lot of MPs, especially MPs who represent rural areas and areas that have struggled to get the sort of coverage that perhaps, you know, the other 85-90% of the country has either got or will be getting imminently, i.e. fibre broadband. But also there's the question about not spots as well, about whether mobile phone coverage is wide enough. Indeed, it was something that the Prime Minister highlighted a few years ago. I think he was off on holiday somewhere and couldn't get through and went back to number 10 and started banging the desk. I mean, I personally live in a rural area myself, and the broadband coverage where we are isn't good, and the mobile phone coverage is pretty much non-existent. Anyway, I'm joined, I'm delighted to say, by Nicole Coby, who is a technology journalist. Hi, Nicole.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. How are you doing?
Not too bad.
Good, good. So, did you follow the debate on Monday with the MPs, and what are your thoughts about what they said? Do you think there's any hope for people like me in rural areas in the next few years?
The next few years might be optimistic. I mean, you describe it as a debate, and of course it is a debate. But the thing is, nobody argues against having better broadband. I mean, there isn't an MP who is ever going to stand up in Parliament and say we should not have better broadband. The problem is more how we're going to get it. And this debate was really talking about a couple of things. One is around BT, because BT completely dominates broadband in this country. And a second thing around universal service commitment. So right now, if you are in a rural area, the aim is within the next couple of years to get you on 2 megabits a second, which I don't know what speed you're getting now, but that's not particularly very fast, especially if you want to get onto things like, you know, iPlayer and Netflix. So the discussion is, you know, what can we increase that universal service commitment to something faster? Is 5 fast enough? Is 10 fast enough? Is any of this even possible without throwing more money at it? So everybody agrees we need better and faster, but the debate is more around how we're going to get it, and is BT going to be able to deliver this to us?
Yeah. And what is your feeling about that? I mean, obviously you've covered this issue for many years now, and I mean, I didn't used to live in a rural area. I used to live in quite a suburban area, but we didn't have fibre there either. And then I've moved to Royal Area, and actually I get about 3-4 maybe on a good day 5 megabits per second down, which is pretty good actually, I think, for a rural area. Up, not so good. It's about 0.4, so it's not so good when you try and do Skype and WebEx and that sort of thing. But I, you know, certainly for iPlayer and things like that. But one thing I did find quite interesting was a few months ago, because I'm with BT, I realised that I could get BT Sport. So I got in touch with them and they said, yeah, that's fine. And you go to this website and you put your number in and blah, blah, blah. And I tried it and it just kept failing and I couldn't understand why it was failing. And in the end, I spoke to them and they said, oh, yeah, your internet connection isn't fast enough to support BT Sport, because I was going to have to get it from the internet and routed through, I think, the UView box that we've got. And so that was the first inkling that I had. Ah, OK, so I thought 5 megabits per second was probably good enough, but actually already it's starting to not be good enough for some services. How much longer is it going to be before some other services start to say, right, yeah, you need a minimum of 6, 7, 8, 10, 15? When 90% of the country's got those sort of speeds, that's not a problem for the 90%, but people in areas that don't have that sort of speed are going to get left behind, aren't they?
Yeah, and this is the phrase that everybody uses for it is digital divide. And the entire country's broadband has been improving. Like, we're all seeing faster speeds. But the gap is kind of widening between, you know, what you're talking about, the kind of rural areas you're talking about of maybe 3 or 4 megabits per second. And, I mean, if you live in an area that's got, you know, proper fiber all the way to your house as opposed to just to a cabinet, we're talking hundreds at this point. So when you start to get into high-def television and things like that, or you have a house and, you know, you've got kids and one of them is using Spotify and one of them is using iPlayer and you're trying to do a Skype call with someone else, you know, that 3 or 4 is not going to be enough. And, yeah, there's going to get to a point where Netflix is saying, hey, you're not going to have enough, you know, you don't have enough bandwidth to be able to take our service. And that's going to be a problem because we're going to be leaving all of these people completely behind. And if we don't start doing something to catch those people up, then they're going to fall very, very far behind very, very quickly.
Yeah. I mean, do you think that we are falling behind other countries? I keep reading things about, like, in Japan and in some Scandinavian countries, they have, like, gigabits per second in certain cities, which, you know, given my paltry speed, just seems like, you know, maybe like someone from Victorian times being teleported into the present. You know, that is kind of difference. I can't really imagine what it would be like to have those sort of speeds. Are they just extreme examples, or on average are we actually doing quite a lot worse than other countries and slipping behind?
It sort of depends how you count. I mean, you could get gigabit speeds in London or in a bigger city if you're willing to pay for it. I mean, the technology is there. It's not something that's impossible to do. A lot of new build developments, like if they're putting in a big office block or a big tower block for people to live in, it's easy to just, you know, run a bunch of fiber cables up to that at the time when you're building it, which is why you see that in, you know, that ability in Asian countries, Korea, and that sort of thing. They get these faster speeds because they tend to have their housing built like that. But if you were to go into rural areas in those countries, I think you'd see very much the same problem. It's just, you know, maybe that's not what we talk about as much. But whether our broadband is good enough or not really depends on what factors you want to consider. So the government likes to say we have the best broadband in Europe, but that's only counting the top or 5 countries, so the big 5 countries in Europe. And it's considering things like speed and coverage and price and market competition and a whole bunch of other factors rather than just speed and just coverage. So for somebody who's living in a rural area, it's really not going to feel like you have the best broadband in Europe because you don't. But somebody in, you know, in Manchester or Birmingham might have what is effectively some of the fastest for the best price. But that doesn't really help the kind of final 5% who are left behind. If the other 95% have the best broadband and those 5% are still left behind, that's still a problem.
Yeah. Now, what are your thoughts about mobile coverage? Generally, but also in the context of potentially, you know, if you've got some of these very outlying areas, like in very far-flung areas of, say, Scotland, where it's just not going to be economically viable probably ever to run fibre cables all the way up there. But I could imagine them putting up, say, a 4G or a 5G, when 5G eventually gets ratified, mast or enough masts to cover those sort of areas, because surely compared to the cost of having to roll fibre cables out to all kinds of different areas, putting up a few masts, wouldn't that be a much better way of actually getting broadband to people in areas that, that maybe can't get, or maybe will never get fibre?
Yeah, and it's definitely, that is definitely something that is being trialled in some areas. There's a lot of things that sort of get in the way, because you have to have just the right frequency to cover kind of long range and things like that. And I've seen BT's run some pilot projects around using what they call fixed wireless. So you're using a mobile signal, but inside your house, it's as though you have a fixed line broadband, that sort of thing. A lot of it will come down to coverage. So with 4G, I think it's O2 that has a coverage obligation where they have to cover 98% of premises in the UK, across the UK, within the next couple of years. But it's that final 2% then that kind of becomes the problem, where those 2% probably, you know, if they can't get mobile, they probably also have problems getting broadband. So there's other technologies. There's things like white space, which is using kind of different kind of the space between other spectrum and that sort of thing to kind of, you know, advance this coverage a little bit more. But for those kind of last 1% or 2%, you might have to start getting into things like satellite, which is getting a lot better, or coming up with a few, you know, different solutions to it. But it's going to take some time.
Yeah, isn't one of the problems with satellite broadband the latency? Because this was something I personally looked into as well. And some of the things that I do, like Skype and WebEx and things like that, do sort of rely on there being a fairly rapid response. In fact, my understanding is that there are some services that will do what's known as a ping. And if they don't get a ping response within, say, 0.2, 0.3 of a second, they just assume that the connection has dropped and you don't get the service. And my understanding from satellite systems is that the latency can be 0.8 of a second, 0.9, because obviously it's got to get all the way up to a satellite and all the way back down again. And that, the best will in the world, is going to take an amount of time, even if it might not seem, it might not sound like much. With computers expecting everything to happen instantaneously, it can make a big difference, can't it?
Yeah, that's true of existing satellite networks. But there's a lot of work that's being done on kind of bringing smaller satellites and having them a lot closer. So instead of having, you know, one big satellite up very, very far, you have some that are quite smaller that are, you know, in a little bit of a closer range. So that could help to get around the latency issues, but those, again, are probably, you know, a few years off. So kind of in the meantime, it's going to mean people, you know, might not be able to use things like VoIP, which is very bad, because if you're very much in the middle of nowhere and you're in a very, very rural place, those are the services that you kind of need the most, because you don't have any, you know, it's a lot harder for you to get in and have meetings and things like that. So yeah, there's solutions. People are thinking about this stuff, but again, you know, there's all these really great, clever ideas that are happening, but, you know, when are they actually going to, you know, come to fruition, and who's going to pay for them when they actually are developed?
Yeah, I mean, that sort of brings us back to the original thing that we were talking about. I mean, the MPs debated this. I mean, are you detecting any signs from what you've picked up from the debate itself that there will be more money forthcoming, that there is now the political will to actually do something about this? Because, you know, if you do have, it might only be, say, 10% of the country that's maybe not getting the coverage that they feel that they need, and that might not sound like that much, but actually quite a lot of constituencies that are having these problems are marginal constituencies, and of course no government wants to annoy the swing voters in the marginal constituencies. So can you envisage a situation where the government might actually throw a lot more money at this just to solve it once and for all?
Yeah, it is something that they've been talking about. And this is where it comes back to the whole idea of a universal service commitment or universal service obligation. The government hasn't said, you know, how much more money they're willing to put into this or how they would go about funding this. But Ed Vasey, who's kind of the broadband minister, has very, very strongly suggested that, you know, 5 megabits per second is just not fast enough. So right now, our minimum is supposed to be 2 by 2017, and he's talking about maybe making it 10 by 2017, or, you know, a few years after that. So it's starting, you know, and for that to happen, it's going to have to be money, and he's the guy that's, you know, holding the purse strings for this, and he's saying 10 is something we're looking at. So that, I think that's a good sign, and that should be, you know, cause for optimism for people in rural areas. But again, it's going to be years for all of this to kind of filter through.
And it sounds like you think that the solution eventually will be a combination of various probably existing technologies and perhaps even newer technologies that will be rolled out over the course of the next few years, that it's unlikely there's ever going to be a one-stop-shop solution. I mean, you mentioned about getting mobile broadband as if it's actually, fixed broadband. And, I mean, I've kind of experimented a little bit with this sort of thing. In fact, I lived in a very remote farmhouse for a couple of months, and I somehow managed to find out that when I was upstairs in this house and I was over on the far side of the house and I put my phone down on the table next to the bed and rotated it 180 degrees and left it there, I could get one, sometimes two bars of 4G. So what I did was I actually left my phone upstairs and I turned it into a hotspot. And I somehow, I also managed to get on Vodafone with that 3 months worth of unlimited 4G they did at the time. And I did say to them, does that mean unlimited? Does it really mean unlimited? And they said, yeah, you can use as much as you like. I think I used 800 gigabytes over the course of 2 months. Yeah, I tested that to the limit. And actually, to be fair to them, they never came back to me and said, you know, when we said that it was unlimited, we lied. No, they actually were good to their word. And it was quite incredible, actually, to be in such a remote place and getting download speeds of about 30 megabits per second and upload speeds of about 12 megabits per second. But in my current house, the signal isn't good enough to be able to do that. But I have been in touch with a local company who are going to come out at some point, I think. And they say they can put, like, an aerial on your roof and then it routes through to some, I think they described it as like a plate that you have that you can then put somewhere in your house. And then you put your device on the plate and then you get, like, a really good 4G signal from that. Now, I'm a bit of a techie and also a bit of an early adopter, so I might go for a solution like that, partly because it would be useful, but also partly because, as a techie, I quite like the idea of having something like that in my house. I can't imagine most people are going to be happy having to have yet another aerial and some plate that they put their devices on, but it strikes me that that might be the first step down a road that in a few years' time could be something much more user-friendly.
Yeah, and I think this is the sort of thing is we need to have our providers, whether it's your ISP or your mobile operator, needs to be a lot more flexible at solving these sorts of problems and have different solutions for it. Which isn't a thing that really happens now. I mean, I've got friends, like I live in London, so I've got great mobile signal and I've got great broadband, but I have a friend down the street who lives in a basement flat and her mobile signal is just completely non-existent. There are all sorts of solutions to this that are off the shelf and she would just need to plug it in and it would be fine, but her mobile operator is just not, it's just not willing, just they don't really want to get involved. You call support and they just say, well, that's just life. And they're going to have to do better than that because we all depend on this. I mean, you're calling me on my mobile device because I don't actually have a landline. If we're depending on mobile and we're depending on our broadband this much, we're going to have these companies that are, you know, offering this do a lot better when it comes to customer service and do a lot better when it comes to solving these problems. So the fact that you're getting that kind of service is a really good sign.
Yeah, but I mean, I've had to sort of snuffle it out myself and find a specialist company that's going to come out and do that for me. And exactly like you said, I mean, I got one of those fixed, mobile but fixed broadband modem things. I got it from EE. Now, as it turned out, they sent it to me. I didn't have a good enough EE signal, so I sent it back. But I had to call them about three times, and the first two times, first of all, I spoke to someone who didn't know what I was talking about. The second time I spoke to someone who said, oh, yeah, we've stopped doing that. For some reason, I ended up calling them back, I think, the following week because I saw another advert for it. And they said, oh, no, I don't know why the person you spoke to said we're not doing it anymore. We are doing it now. So it's not just that it actually strikes me that a proper long-term solution to this is going to be different companies talking to each other and coming up with hybrid solutions that might need to be delivered by one, two, maybe three companies working in conjunction with each other. But the companies themselves internally don't even quite know what's going on yet. So I think we might be a few years away from, God forbid we need another government body, but maybe we do need some kind of coordination organization that can look at a person and say, okay, you've got a problem, you haven't got good broadband, how can we solve it for you? And it might be that it's satellite, it might be that it's mobile, it might be that we can somehow get fibre or something else. And at the moment, there isn't really anything like that. You just have to find it out yourself. And I suspect I will eventually get a solution, just because I'm the sort of person who will just keep going and keep going.
Yeah.
But you shouldn't really have to do that. It should be easier than this, shouldn't it?
Yeah, it should be. And the thing is, there's a lot of little communities that are in rural areas that have had success by kind of, you know, they have somebody in the community who's very tech savvy, and they all kind of band together, and they apply for funding, and they figure out the different solutions themselves. But they kind of shouldn't have to. I mean, some of the people involved in these projects, it's absolutely fabulous what they're doing, and it's, you know, great that they're able to do that, but it, you know, it's terrible to think that there's another community down the road that just doesn't have anyone who's tech savvy enough to find out about this stuff and to know who to talk to and all of that sort of thing. So, yeah, I like the idea of having, you know, some sort of a digital communications consumer rights body. I wouldn't hold my breath if Ofcom setting something like that up anytime soon.
Yeah, maybe the government need to nominate a digital divide czar, and then, as we know from the past, every time the government appoints a czar, then everything gets sorted in that particular area, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's been great to talk to you, Nicole. How can people get hold of you on social media and so forth if they want to?
Oh, I'm on Twitter as NJ Kobe, so NJKOBIE. So you can come, I don't know, follow me on Twitter is probably the best way.
Okay. And where can people read your journalism these days?
I'm still at PC Pro, so PC Pro is probably the best place, especially when it comes to broadband stuff. So the next issue, we've got quite a bit of stuff on this topic. So
oh, good stuff.
An issue.
Well, I'm a subscriber, so I'll be reading that. Okay. Thanks very much, Nicole.
Okay. Thanks, Mark.
Okay, so that was Nicole Kobe, who is a technology journalist, and we're talking about broadband there. Like I say, if you want to get hold of me any time during the show, then you can get hold of me at Mark Reckons. I'll be back here next week, and one of the subjects that we're going to cover next week is drugs policy. That's ever a controversial issue. So if you want to tweet me about that any time between now and then, or even during the show, at Mark Reckons, be happy to read out your contributions, as long as they're readoutable. And I'm going to be joined by Steve Rolls, who is head of an organisation called Transform Drug Policy Foundation, which is based in Bristol. And he has actually just been appointed head of a new Lib Dem committee that's going to review drugs policy and make some recommendations. So it'll be good to speak to him. And as I say, I'll be back next week with that and with other topics and other guests as well.